recall that I tried to pick the American Creed out of six primary sources: the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the Gettysburg Address, the 14th Amendment, the poem The New Colossus, which appears now in the Statue of Liberty, and the Pledge to the Flag. Running through all these are a couple of themes, the strongest of which perhaps is the notion of equality and equal treatment before the law, and equal justice. And another strong theme running through all of these is the notion of liberty, the notion that we have some rights as human beings which we claim against the government. We do not think any majority has the authority to overrule. Does that sound familiar to those of you who are here? Have I left out something that we should put on the record for today? It's a little embarrassing to think that I took 45 minutes to say that yesterday. I was able to say it in 2 minutes today. I want to say some other things today. First, for those of you who heard me at 9 o'clock defending capitalism with a quote from the scriptures and so on, I want to offer my apologies and to assure you that I was fulfilling an assigned role. And it seemed to me that what I was saying was errant nonsense, and that I do appreciate and thank you for your courtesy in allowing me to say it without jumping all over me afterwards. But I guess I would have thanked you more deeply, with more feeling, if you had objected to what I said. It seems to me that much of the gap between the words of the American Creed and our deeds as Americans lies in just this area, that we have a commitment to an American way of life. We have a commitment to the American success story, which seems to me to contradict what we say we believe in. For me, my interpretation of American freedom, American equality, and so on, is rooted very, very deeply in the scriptures. I recognize we all read the scriptures differently, and we all see different things in them. This is perhaps one reason they're so valuable and last for so long and have such an appeal to so many people that one can find about what one wants, I suppose, in the scriptures, including a defense of the American way of life. The gospel that I read seems to me to contradict much of the American way. You heard, some of you heard last night, what we think the Lord's Prayer would sound like if it were written to support American business enterprise, if it was written by good Chamber of Commerce booster. Let me read another revision of the scriptures. The contrast between the scriptures that we were taught and this that I'm about to read, I hope will point out for us some of the basis for the gap between our claims of equality and liberty and justice for all, and our performance. Now, a certain rich man had two sons. The younger came to him one day and asked for his inheritance, that he might seek his fortune. The father gave the son the money, which the son wasted and lost in riotous living. But one day the son realized that little of his inheritance remained unto him, so he became sober and frugal. He hit upon many schemes for increasing his wealth and always managed to stay just inside the law. He found he could make lots of money from unsuspecting poor people, and soon he was able to invest money in deeds, stocks, and bonds, so that he no longer had to go out in the heat of the day to trick people out of their money. When he returned home, his father was greatly impressed and called his son a chip off the old block and threw a big party, hoping to lure the son into a partnership. The older son was most envious and asked his father why he never threw a party for him, since he'd always done what his father had asked. The father snorted, "Thou fool, thou can never get ahead following orders. Thy brother is smart and rich, and I want to share in his gains. But I can always count on thee to do my bidding for the allowance I give thee. Why should I waste my hard-won money on a party for thee?" And he laughed in his elder son's face and went and embraced the younger son. Well, you recognize some contradiction there, I hope. That's not the way we were brought up, is it? But isn't that, this travesty that I've just read, isn't that genuinely in keeping with the American success story, with the American sense of achievement? I guess I didn't hear any answer. Did somebody say no?
I'd say right now.
Right now.
So,
you said no.
What?
Tim just said no.
No, no.
I know too many nice, kind, honest men in business.
I just said. It doesn't deny the possibility of being kind and honest.
I think the idea of their basic dishonesty or something, or getting where they are, but I'm not so sure that's based on as much fact as it is a continual reiteration of this same story over and over, because it makes a good novel, you know, it makes a good story, but I don't know that it's necessarily true.
I didn't want to suggest that this person was dishonest or unkind. I want to stress the contrast between the success ethic and the teaching of the gospel that says we're all one in Christ, that doesn't tell us to go out and succeed. It doesn't tell us to become prosperous. I mean, I don't have any problem with the good heartedness of many successful people. I do have a problem with what drives us. What goals do we have? And the problems in the gap between the American creed and the American performance seem to me to result from this contradiction.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but this just really fits what you're saying. I don't know if any of you noticed in Time magazine about 3 weeks ago, on the personals page where they have all that gossip stuff, they always have some little quotes, like two or three little quotes. This was a quote of Mother Teresa, and the little thing said, Mother Teresa was asked, "Don't you get discouraged in your work amongst the poor in India?" And her response was, "God did not call me to succeed, he called me to be faithful."
I don't know if the tape picked it up, but Mother Teresa's point was that she was not called to succeed, but to be faithful. Perhaps I would be digressing, but I'd pursue that a step further. For me, one of the most important liberating thoughts I picked up was to realize that I don't have to succeed, that it's enough to try. That one of the problems many of us have with conferences like this is we talk about these great cosmic issues and we don't solve anything. We don't get any answers. And there's a kind of frustration involved for some people in that failure. And gradually I've come around to think that, well, there's a kind of arrogance in thinking that somehow we might be able to solve these eternal questions which none of our predecessors have ever solved before. If Plato couldn't, or Socrates couldn't, define justice, what on earth makes us think that we can? And so it's not up to us to succeed, is it? It's just up to us to run the race.
You don't run a race unless you intend to finish it.
Unless what?
Unless you want to finish. A race isn't a race unless you're striving.
We'll finish, but we don't have to finish first. St. Paul tells us that only one will finish first, and it's not going to be most of us. It's enough that we run well, that we try.
But that's a success right there if you finish it at your best.
All right, in that sense. Yes, we can buy that.
But you might not finish it.
It's okay to fail and not finish it.
Yes, well, but we're all going
to
finish.
But you intend, you don't start it unless you intend to run your best and try to finish.
We're all going to finish it. If the race is light, we're all going to finish it. That's no problem. And the question is how we run it. And let's see if we can look more directly at what I've been calling the gap. Again, to remind some of you, and perhaps some of you didn't hear me say, in my judgment, in my view, the gap between the claims of America, which are so great, which make such a universal appeal for 200 years, the gap between the creed and the performance is smaller today than ever before in our history. That we have brought more people in than ever before. The country started out as a completely white adult male dominated society. In many of our original states, white adult males couldn't vote unless they were property owners and unless they belonged to the correct religion. Happily, from my point of view, happily from the point of view of the claims of the creed, all those religious and property qualifications have been swept away. The sexual qualification has been swept away. The racial qualification has been swept away. And we have even made a gesture towards admitting that young people are people. We dropped the age 3 whole years, much to the consternation of many old people, to see these immature 18-year-olds voting and drinking and all those terrible things. My own students are kind of strange about this. Before the 18-year-olds got the vote, my students were in favor of lowering the voting age. But now that the 18-year-olds have the vote, my students are against lowering the voting age. They're seem to me like everybody else, that the last reform, the reform which brought me in, or which brought my family in, was the last legitimate reform. And we mustn't have any more. But
can I just throw
please.
In here, one of Paul's colleagues coined a phrase, which I think is very good. And what's more, it's alliterative, it's easy to remember. It's people in power prefer to preserve prevailing patterns. It's very simple, everybody understands that. It's
people possessing political power prefer preserving prevailing patterns. It wasn't one of my colleagues.
It was.
You did.
Okay,
all
right.
One more time.
People possessing political power prefer preserving prevailing patterns. They prefer it, they don't always succeed in doing it. But it's a good, you watch a lot of politics and you'll see it's true that candidates are for a lot of reforms which incumbents say aren't required. You've heard a lot of people advocate changing form of presidential election, but the president who's sitting in the White House has a tendency to say, well, there's a lot wrong with the Electoral College, but after all, it works, and so let's not meddle with it. But it's one of the great ways of seeing all history, that the establishment which gives is the establishment that survives, and the establishment which tries to hold the line too strictly is the one that's overthrown. And the more successful establishment is at holding the line, the greater the trauma when the change finally comes. You can contrast the British, French, and Russian monarchies. You see it very clearly. The British monarchy was apparently the least successful of the three, starting when the barons got King John down and forced the Magna Carta out of him. And from then on, a continual sharing of what had been the monarch's prerogatives with more and more people until finally not only the lesser nobility, but the aristocracy, the landed aristocracy, and then got down in the 19th century to ordinary working men, and the 20th century even women sharing in what had been the prerogative of the crown. And the crown still sits on the head of a British monarch. The Bourbons, more successful at claiming and holding their medieval prerogatives, produced the French Revolution, from which France has yet to recover. And the Romanovs, more successful than the Bourbons, preserving their medieval prerogatives well into the 20th century, were overthrown by a revolution which the world has not yet recovered from. So I think, a lesson in there for all of us. That's, those of you who are historians are probably shuddering at my amateur work with history and see it as an oversimplification, but I think you'll also see a great deal of truth in it. The American story is certainly one of growth, of one of constant change, of constant, and I think the line, the direction of this growth is clear. It's in direction of fulfilling the creed which didn't have much meaning to start with, comes to have more and more. But what I hope we could do this morning was look further at the gap. If we say we believe that we're all created equal, what do we find when we look around our society? Let me just repeat, by equality I don't mean sameness. I'm not asking that we all be the same. I don't want to be the same. I don't want you all to be the same as each other. It's in your individuality that you have your being, and that earns my respect and earns my recognition of our equality.
Gunnar. One of the things I think everyone knows is here is that the minorities themselves, of course, have really made almost zero headway and as far as where they should be for equality. And women have made, I think, a great deal of headway as minorities, but then they have power. They are part of our family. They are one with the other. They have a great deal of power. Minorities still don't have a power or seemingly a way in which they can convince all of us that they should have more rights. I mean, more equal. I mean, their equality should be being fulfilled right now instead of in time, sometime down the track. It's a very great disappointment to see all of us not really allowing them that full equality which is so evident that they should have. And yet the women now are getting this equality because they do have a power.
And there must be a little bit,
but much more than minority, much more than blacks, and much more than Mexicans, etc.
But
there's a different attitude towards the power, I think, of women.
Don't you think, Gunnar, you're talking about a specific group of women?
White, yes, I am talking about a specific group of women. White.
Well, and even white, even white, I think you have to say middle class, educated, with certain skills.
The ones who are putting up the fight, and who are these people, I think?
Well, not all the ones who are putting up the fight, I think. I think it's ones who have been able, because of certain attributes that they have, who knows why they got them, a certain very small group of women. I'm really reluctant to say that women's movement has been tremendously successful and the other groups, the other minorities, not. I find that a bit.
Well, my only gauge for success is where are they in the stream of life, where they want to be, their pursuit of their happiness, their liberty, their descendant. Where are those other minorities compared to these women you were just talking about? And I see that it's such a large discrepancy, and it's a tremendous disappointment.
I think you have to talk to quite a lot of women to be sure
That.
Hmm? I think you have to talk to quite a lot of women to be sure if they feel that they are in the place that you feel that they're in.
I just wonder what women feel that they want right now that they don't have. Like, this is all new to me. I'm not you know, haven't kept abreast of it.
Sigmund Freud asked the same question. What is it that women want?
Well, my point wasn't, well, I lost my point there, but the point was this discrepancy between the creed that you discussed yesterday and the needs today for equality, that it requires some kind of a power base for people to get this in our country, whereas it shouldn't. It's there already. As we all know, and this is something that's just common knowledge, it's in the Constitution, it's in the Bill of Rights, it's in all of these things that we have in our creed. They shouldn't have to fight for this, yet there takes a basic power structure to get this, sometimes violent.
Yes, we could certainly say that the 14th Amendment imposes all the requirements of the Equal Rights Amendment mm-hmm. on the states. The 14th Amendment says no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person equal protection of the law. So that if the Equal Rights Amendment had never been proposed, we could well argue that it would be superfluous if there hadn't been 110 years of history intervening, during which those words were in the Constitution, but never in the law of the land, never in the behavior of the people. Those words were in the Constitution for half a century when women weren't even allowed the right to vote. So we see the tremendous gap between the wording of the document and the behavior of the society. And I'm 56 years old. I started out a genuine traditional male chauvinist. I just thought the difference was inherent, was biological, it was scriptural. I really believed that stuff that Larry shot down this morning. The first creation story just whipped right by, and I never saw it. I really believe Adam, a male with male genitals, existed all by himself and was lonely, and God created a female for Adam's benefit. I believed that. And I didn't meet a woman after I got my height. I never met a woman my height until just last year. So I could easily feel superior to male. And just in the last, 10 years, is it? That like the rest of you men, I think, that I've become sensitized to the dissatisfaction of women. I didn't see, why should they be dissatisfied? What was wrong with the way women were living? Women had control of a lot of wealth and had pretty good jobs and pretty nice homes. All the women I knew had good homes to live in, had good husbands and so on. So I didn't see what women had to complain about. Well, I've been sensitized and I'm more aware that, yeah, women are genuinely, honestly frustrated by being kept in their place. Why should women have a place to be kept in?
And it's not just the American women. I mean, you have to look through the whole world and just look around and see where women are in all these other cultures.
Yeah, well, that reinforced my sense of male chauvinism. It showed how right it was. It was universal. Even in the Soviet Union, after 60, 70 years, nearly 70 years of, I lose track of the date, after more than 60 years of this revolution of equality, and women have got a tremendous amount of political equality in the Soviet Union. For example, in the practice of medicine, there are more female physicians than there are males. After all this time, now we're talking about virtually two generations, but these equal women are still expected to go home and take care of the household, still expected to take care of the kids and feed the family and do all those women's things at home.
Well, and even the women doctors are not the professors of medicine, they're not the administrators, they're not the ones with the big practice.
The big surgeon.
Right, what they are the GPs. I mean, they're doing the step work of medicine.
You know, it isn't so much that, you know, taking it from a negative that I've been so deprived or that anybody is doing something to me. I never looked at it from that, because I enjoyed my role as a mother and a homemaker and all those roles that have been assigned to women from year one, you know. But I guess that when I finally moved out of into a profession, that the healing that went on for me was that at last I was in the stream of life. And I had, and all those things that I was capable of doing and my potential beyond doing, the homemaking and the mothering and the being a good wife, and I hope I still did that well too when I took on that, but I had capacity to do much more. And I think that, in answer to this gentleman's question back here, well, what does woman want? It's not that, you know, that what we've been asked to do through the ages is, there's nothing wrong with that, but I think that the denial has come in around that women have tremendous gifts that they have never used. And I can remember very well, being conscious of this when I was a very little girl, because I had a tremendous grandmother whom I adored and who had a great influence on my life. And she was a marvelous homemaker and a marvelous, she sustained, you know, the grandchildren and her own children. And she was very active with young people in her church. But I always knew from the time I was just a little person, you know, in age, that my grandmother had so much more that she could give, but she there was no place for her to put it. I sensed a great frustration in her. And I think, you know, my willingness to go on and try to pursue some other things had a lot to do with, you know, with her.
Well, I think what women are saying is, we'd like some choices. Not that there's anything wrong with the roles. Men have those same roles, but they get to make some choices.
That's
they don't have to say, am I going to be a father? If I'm going to be a father, that's it, kiddo. No, you get to be a father and some other things too. But I think that the other side is also true, that men haven't had as many choices as they could have. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with a man staying home sometimes and baking or whatever he wants to do, staying home with his kids? What's wrong with that? I think a lot of men might like it if they were given the choice. The trouble with keeping one section of the population in its place is that means there's only one other place for the other section of the population. It's not a very good arrangement.
I'll tell you a family story. I brought up to understand that my parents met because during World War I, my mother went back to school to do graduate work in chemistry. My father was a professor of chemistry. And she was studying chemistry so she could relieve a man for the front. And I always thought, what a nice patriotic thing that was. And time went on, and a few years later, I found myself at the front. And I thought, my mother was getting a job to bounce some guy out of his job so that he could come and get himself shot up here. So I changed my perspective on this a great deal. And it also changed my perspective. I want you to understand, in a very literal sense, one of the things that happened to me is some Germans tried to kill me. I think about all these innocent women and children I'd been hearing about. And I was trying to figure out, what was I guilty of? How come it's all right to kill me because I happen to have male genitals? That makes it all right to kill me. But it's wrong to kill women and children. So the other side of the equality issue, perhaps, that one of the things I look forward to as we get more and more equality is that this burden of military obligation will be shared by a larger percentage of the population. Perhaps as more people are involved in it, the opposition to it will be more effective. It would be kind of neat if all over the world women would suddenly find themselves facing the obligation and say, hey, we don't want this. And the only way for us to get out of it is to get the men out of it too. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. Well, in regards to that particular topic, Ellen Midman, who a number of people read, I think, commented on this a few weeks ago in terms of the draft and equality in terms of choices. And that relates to blacks and Indians and Chicanos and so on. And she's written, she had written against that. However, she said, you know, in terms of being a part of, being within the equality thing, men and women, is that women may have to opt to register and to be available for the armed forces, and not to be available for men, as she talks in the foxholes, to provide service for men, sexually, but to be, you know, equal at that point. When she, of course, talks in regards to peace and not war, but she, in this article, had to deal with that again, in terms of the equality issue that that we are attempting to go for. And we as men cannot get off the hook by saying, well, I don't seem to know what's going on with women, with blacks, with Chicanos. We have to somehow get in tune with what we have, what choices we have, and what choices we do not have. And sense that that this thing about equality is something that we have to fight for with all we've got.
This notion she had brought up and you had brought up, I think I feel very deeply about, that's this notion of choice. That's a very, you know, that's quite a word, you know, that people have choice when we realize, of course, that many people don't have choice. And it seems we have to, in some way, engage in some kind of restructuring of our basic thinking from our creed. Because that's what it talks about, we should have freedom of choice. And as my own life experience went about, I spent 15 years as a cartographer, 10 years as a teacher, and now I'm into woodworking, which I enjoy very much. And for the first time, I see a vast area of potential that people who want to do what they want to do and their choice is out there. If you take the courage to be by yourself, work on your own, and take this chance, now that's a very... that's a risky thing, to not work for somebody else, but to work for yourself. But there is so much work out there. I don't even think in terms of competition, because there's so much work to do. I feel I'll be working until I'm 80 if I want to, as long as you do a good job and you follow your choice and do what you want to do. And this is where maybe much of our frustration in this world is we've got to restructure our thinking to how can we allow people to have more choice in the things that they want to do? And of course, this means, well, we were talking yesterday about the notion of big business and greed. Now, I think business thwarts, and I think all of you would agree, I mean, this is something we all know, thwarts the ability of someone to have choice in what they do. And many people have written about this, and many books written about this, so there's nothing new. But here is where minorities, women and the whole thing, I think all of this comes in. If we could just think in terms of choice and restructuring our thinking, not restructuring our society and the things we have in society, our material, but how do we actually go about getting these goods? How are the talents of people being wasted? And I think a lot of things that big business does can be done by individuals or very small groups of people equally well and for maybe even a cheaper price. But it's very difficult for us to think in those terms, because in America we think big. And after working with and studying, you know, for 10 years of third world problems, I get to thinking, hey, I know that this is, we're a very small minority in the world. We think big, we in the West. But I think we could restructure our thinking, and here's where much of our energy should go, is restructuring this kind of thing to give people choice. And I believe blacks and Chicanos would come literally out of the woodwork and be doing these marvelous things in manufacturing whatever they like to do and whatever they work about. And but this choice, I think it is the element that I feel deepest about, that a person must be able to choose. No one can dominate, no one can tell you what to do in your life, and no one can should be able to have this tremendous pressure over you that if we get a little competition, suddenly 300,000 people are out of work. This just seems so unjust in relation to the whole world of things, not just our own country, but the whole world. The idea of coming up with trade tariffs or something, when actually that cuts away all of the all of the ability for people around the world to make choices by just having tariffs, because they cannot compete in your world. You don't allow this to happen. And I don't think it's too radical. Many economists are writing on that. Let's do away with tariffs or something. Let's allow these people who can work in small ways to compete with us, and we too would probably determine more small ways. But get this big organization ethic out. Multinationals, I hate with a passion. But I'm sorry, I said too much.
That's a good thing.
Well, it raises some things that I think you probably would want to be talking about anyway, because we've been kind of going back and forth for a couple of days now. Choice and freedom and liberty, that concept. And to what extent can we, to what degree can we push that? How far can we push that? And in relationship to that, how interdependent are we? And as Christians, how corporate are we? How community-oriented are we? Those issues seem to really come up under the American creed as well as the Christian ethic.
Well, we have a somewhat easier fallback position, I think, we're focusing on right now. And the problem of choice is very, very difficult. And none of us believe in giving freedom of choice to everybody to do whatever they choose to do. We just don't want to live in a jungle where some people choose to foul the nest, or some people choose to steal or rape. We don't want complete freedom of choice. But what we're talking about is a little easier. We're saying, let's not, I think, at least some of us think, let's not restrict choice on the basis of some artificial pigeonholing, like sex, like race, like religion. Say, regardless of these differences that we have, I want to assure you, even at my age, I really appreciate the difference in sex between me and my roommate. I'm for the difference. I'm in favor of the difference. But from that difference, that difference doesn't form a basis, a legitimate basis, for restricting the roommate's choice. It does. It's a little bit easier to see, I hope. And this, I suppose, this is really what all women are asking, all blacks are asking. Not be pigeonholed and told, you don't have the same choices that other people have because of your sex, because of your race, because of your religion, because of your family's ethnic origin. Yeah.
The thing that,
Dave?
Don,
excuse me, Don.
The thing that makes me wonder is I hear, you know, we had women probation officers and we were revolutionary. They could have men on probation. We could have women on probation. It raised a lot of questions and problems and so forth. We worked it out. But the thing that bothers me is I wonder if women haven't learned that from men that to be real means to push people around. I see a lot of women yell, scream, push, scratch, shout about equal rights and the differences, and they've just taken male roles. I think women have more to offer than simply, I want to be the president of the company so I can push that so-and-so around who's been pushing me around for 25 years. We have a friend of ours who lives with us and who, that's really a lot of her feeling. And I just don't think, I think women have got to have more. I mean, I feel like they're being restricted mentally by what they've seen men do. You know, the president of General Motors, or the guy, they had a guy at Lockheed who used to walk around and he saw a guy at the coffee table, 2 minutes more, he'd fire him on the spot. Now that's what it really means to be a man, see? And I see out of a lot of women that I know just wanting to do that and calling that equality. And that there's gotta be more than that.
Sure, you know what I mean? I think you're absolutely right. And that's what I'm saying about these choices. Why do women have to be, in order to be feminine, traditionally women must be nurturing, submissive, quiet, so on and so forth. In order to be male, masculine, what do men have to be? tough, athletic, aggressive, assertive. See, what's assertive in a man is pushy in a woman, right? And that's, you know, you're right. In neither of them is it pleasant. So why do we act as though that's what we started out talking about? You know, what's so great about being first? What's so great about being always top dog? And we're saying, how did that climb into the American creed? That wasn't there to start with, was it?
So yeah, well, none of us rush to be servants.
Beg your pardon?
None of us rush to be servants.
Exactly. You're right.
Well, but I think that's politically what's happening in the country is that women are saying, we're going to shove you. You've been shoving us around for a long time now, boys, and now we're going to shove you around. And that, I personally am confident enough that it ain't going to work. I mean, I think the boys are going to come out better, see? Just like, I don't
just
think...
Just wait.
Give Gunner a chance.
I'm not trying to counter what he says, because he's speaking in a different world than I'm going to be speaking in, but... many of you have been teachers, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. But it doesn't take very long in the teaching profession to gain a great deal of respect for a woman's ability to deal with issues and problems and solving them and dealing with them without pushiness, without anything, just good cooperation. That's what I found in the teaching profession. And boy, I say, I found women who I respect and admire beyond all.
I agree. I'm talking women. About recently, though.
But, well, there's to the business world, maybe there's a difference between the business group, but I find women to be excellent in holding to the issues when they're dealing with, you know, when you're dealing with them on business of any nature that I've dealt with them, especially in teaching. But matter of fact, they keep me on the ball. They keep me honest. That's what I find. I find to be very, very good at that.
Of course, I think women are very comfortable in teaching because that's been a tradition and profession for women, and maybe
they're also bosses. I mean, yeah. I have them directing me at things, and me, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it goes around. And I've been very comfortable with it. I found it to be a very good experience.
Well, after 31 years.
Of course, I'm saying this only because my wife is here. If she wasn't here, I wouldn't say so.
I just reminded how, when in the black thing, it was in the 60s and so on, we got to the point where we said, well, I know some really good blacks who can do thus and so, you know. And we still identified each other by that. We got so far to go because, doggone it, there are situations where I really can feel like if I achieve, someone saying, you know, she does pretty well for a woman.
Yes.
And that you know, there's that little grating that happens when you sense that. So we have a ways to go for getting that into our
heads. Doesn't that go both ways? I've heard women say he's pretty sensitive for a man.
Sure.
I think there's so much. I mean, why? If women are so damn confident now and smart, you know, let me take you on for a minute here. Why all the damn sniveling? I mean, you know, you're looking at men. You know, part of my deal. My mother has been a woman's liver for 75 years. Okay. And it ain't, if you're gonna go into combat and be a hero, some guys are gonna get shot and killed. And you can't stand around the guy and say, geez, we didn't expect this to happen. You know, we wanted to all be heroes, but the guy's gonna die. Some women are gonna get it, and there's gonna be suffering and pain. We can't have this.
I wonder what women you know. Because I have trouble relating to that. I mean, I do know women who are considered very pushy and do behave that way and attempt to be very...
I just watched the Democratic National Convention. I don't know, maybe I get too upset about those kind of things. You know? I see a lot of women who speak out, and I'm a blabbermouth myself. I'm not saying anything about that. But I think that very often I hear men and women, and I include women, that's my point in this, in that we want to change. I think this gentleman was trying to make that point. We want new jobs and we want to be different, but we don't want to pay the price. I just quit the bureaucracy. And it is painful. And I don't enjoy a lot of the whole deal about this farming business, you know? You've got to water the damn trees, you've got to watch them, there's gophers, there's deer, you got to put up fences. You know, it's inconvenient, and I don't like a lot of it. It's not the fairyland, to some extent, I thought it was going to be. But I ain't going to go back.
You got a choice, though, right?
That's right. I mean, I don't think people in this country understand that anymore.
Responsibility comes with choice.
Pain, yeah, you damn right it does. And I think a lot of men, and this hasn't been said, I know a lot of men who've paid that price, and I don't hear anybody talking about it for them. I know a lot of alcoholics who are very in a lot of pain. And their wives aren't that damn sensitive to them. Their wives are driving their cars and doing this and going to junior college and just having and talking about women's rights. And this poor Seth is still out there ready to have his first heart attack. And they're going to cart him off. And she's going to get it all. Now, who's talking about that?
Paul, you said you were a male chauvinist for about 10 years ago. Did you treat your wife any different before this?
Well,
somehow, that was a matter of compartmentalization. I did expect my wife to be satisfied with her job in the home. And I can remember once, after we'd married perhaps 15 years, about halfway back, a blow up in which I just threw that in her face and said, well, that's what you got married for, then that's your job, that's your role. But normally, I think that wasn't our problem, that I was able to compartmentalize. As Teddy told some of you yesterday, we used to trade off some on staying home and going to work while I was in graduate school and while I was a junior faculty member. There were summers where Betty was the breadwinner and I was the homemaker, and it seemed to go very, very well. But even while I was doing that, I still had the conventional view that what I was doing was woman's work, but I didn't mind doing it. It had its own pleasures and rewards. I had some time to do some writing when the kids quieted down. And I had some embarrassing moments. I was out hanging up the laundry one day, and I was wearing a little apron to hold the clothes. And I had on a pair of shorts, you know, and I had no top. And a little urchin from the neighborhood came and he studied me quite a while. He was probably 6 years old. And I could see he had a problem, and he studied me. And finally he said, "Are you a man or a woman?" I looked like a man, but boy, I was sure acting.
Did you have your mustache?
No mustache then.
I had no problem about my manhood, which I think made it easier for me to do that. I think a lot of men are very insecure about their manhood. But I had survived that combat infantry experience, which is kind of the typical or the archetypical male role. I mean, that's even better than being a good football player, isn't it?
Amen.
And
you get a kill.
And I had five children. Well, I sincerely believed I had five children.
He had five children, but at no time did he think that taking care of those children, changing dirty diapers, cleaning up the spilled milk, all that stuff, was my job. I mean, he just always thought that was all right to do. I don't know that it was particularly ingrained that this was man's work, women's work particularly. It was just, there was a hell of a lot of work to be done, and, you know, we sort of did it together when he was around. To be sure, he wasn't around all the time. The other thing was, I don't remember any time when we had a discussion or a difference of opinion about should I take a part-time job, should I take another part-time job, should I expand my part-time, and I realized that that's a big deal for a lot of men, and that wasn't. I think we both understood that once I got those kids sort of straightened out a little bit, that I would go to work. Now, to me, it's kind of funny that in retrospect, it didn't occur to me until I had number five in school that I could get a job. But I don't think that was Paul particularly. I think that was my whole upbringing went way, way back. If you were a mother, you stayed home and took care of those kids.
Yeah, Betty's mother was more of a male chauvinist than I was.
Yeah. It wasn't just any one thing. It was my whole orientation. If you got married, you had kids. If you had kids, you stayed home and took care of them. That's what you do.
And well, the times they are changing,
right? Right, right.
That's not what you taught your children then, is it?
No. In fact, much later, my number one son said to me one day, after I was at the university and more or less confident about my other abilities, he said, I always wondered what you were doing with a master's degree, staying home, you know, doing all the kind of stuff you were doing. Now, isn't that funny? He never said that to me as long as I was doing it.
This is our tactful son.
He didn't also have maybe as many insights at that age about what
was involved.
That's right. Yeah, what you were really doing as a parent, that it wasn't just dishes and on their lives.
Yeah, right, right. Mm-hmm. No, I think we tried to let our kids know that they didn't have to have a role. Although I'm embarrassed to say, my girls are sure a lot better at the women's kind of thing than the boys are.
It depends a little. I was amazed to discover one of my daughters couldn't cook when she was, she was already 20, I think. I said, what's this? You know, she offered to cook dinner one night and Betty was gone. It was one of the worst dinners I ever had. I was surprised, but she learned to cook, too.
Right.
And, I don't know how much cooking either the boys. Well, we've been concentrating on women, which is a good thing for us to be concentrating on because so many of us are. We've not, except in passing, done much with race relations in America. But let's take a moment on it at least, and perhaps I get some response from you if I just say that if we look backward, we've come a long way. That there have been major developments that are not to be taken lightly. As recently as when we went south, there were a dozen states or more in the Union that had state laws assigning place to people on the basis of race and prohibiting certain kinds of interracial relations, even if the individuals involved might want to engage in those relations. A black and a white university student wanted to go out to the downtown dime store lunch counter and have a cup of coffee together. They might want to do that, but when I first went to Tallahassee, both the state law and the city ordinances said that was illegal. That was a crime against the people of the state of Florida, and if they wouldn't do that, they would be subject to arrest. It happened, as some of you will recall, in many parts of the country, that college students, university students, did break those state and local laws and were arrested. The informal classification of people by race and the informal assignment of roles was perhaps more pervasive and stronger, more pervasive in the sense it was nationwide. Minnesota, where we're more from than Florida, in a way, has very, very few black people in the population. And the ones that were in the population were kept virtually invisible, not by state law, but just by informal agreements. No good downtown hotel in Minneapolis would accept a black customer. It was all right for blacks to handle the food, but it wasn't all right for them to eat it in the same dining room. And the idea that they might ride up the same elevators and sleep in the rooms was just, no first-class hotel would permit that in Minneapolis, or I suppose in your hometown either at that time. The notion of blacks being in public office was no notion at all. There was no such thing. There was no black mayor of Cleveland, there was no black mayor of Los Angeles, there was no black mayor of Tallahassee, which we've lived to see. Looking backwards, we can point to major developments towards equality. And I wonder if you sense any hurt among white people as a result of that. Any diminishing of a white person's identity, of a white person's rights, of a white person's freedom, any loss of what whites really care about in the changing acceptance of blacks in public life and at the bar of justice at law. I would be surprised. No. I know there's some people around who don't enjoy going out to restaurants anymore because there are black people in the restaurants. I know there are such people, but they must be few and far between in your experience, aren't they? I don't. Is there anybody here who feels hurt? Yeah, thank you.
I think that the people that probably have the most fear of the minorities becoming equal are the ones who are not sure of keeping their own job. You know, if you let this man become, or woman become, equal to me, they're going to bump me out of my place getting into graduate school. They're going to bump me out of the job that I want. You know, they have these quotas you have to take now. And it's the people that are fighting to get in that same job that are the ones that I think are giving us the most static inequality. Because it's going to hurt them personally in their jobs or their career advancement.
Yeah, but I think what you're saying is exactly right. That's what they're predicting for the future. What we're wondering is, has that actually happened?
Well, like, I personally don't mind or care or have any feelings about it because I am not in a position of maybe losing my job, you know, because of someone else suddenly getting equality. And I think the ones that are most frightened of minorities getting equality are the ones that are in danger of losing.
You're making a strong point. There's a marginal group of people who feel threatened, who are insecure. And it's very realistic for insecure people to feel threatened. Nothing wrong going on there.
Well, isn't that what's happening in Miami? I mean, with the
Cuban... I think it's happening in a lot of it. Certainly, a lot of the construction trade unions, for example. The union members are resisting racial integration on this time. But while it seemed to me appropriate for an insecure person to feel threatened, what's inappropriate is to feel threatened by a racial group. The problem is a problem of the economy, the problem of individual skill and individual place in the economy. And if an insecure individual can appreciate, I'm insecure because I don't have the talents and the economy isn't providing sufficient opportunities, and I may lose my job. I have, you know, a large number of people are always losing their job. They're unemployed sometimes for weeks at a time between jobs. They don't stay on. Most people don't stay unemployed very long. But in some cases, it stretches out to a painful long period. It makes sense for these people to be sensitive to their own insecurities. What does make sense is for them to think that they can become secure at the expense of a racial group or a sexual group, to protect themselves at the expense of strangers without any thought to the stranger's personal qualifications and attributes, without any thought to, does that person have the qualities which are desirable, which are looked for, and which are going to bounce me out. Don't deal with the individual, put a label on the group, and keep the whole group off the job market, and then I'll have a better shot at it. Or to keep that whole group out of the medical school, and I'll have a better shot at it. Well, how do you like to have Becky be your doctor someday?
Okay, I don't know what it's like in your state. In California, the state colleges have set up a quota, and by the time a person is ready for graduate school, say medical school, that's a good example, I think that they should be competing on grades, you know, equally, but they don't. A minority is allowed in with a lower grade average than the majority white Anglo-Saxon. And
And maybe to get into college, I could see that because they haven't had the educational opportunity. But by the time they're ready for graduate school, I would want them, my position, for instance, to be as good as possible and not somebody they let in because he was a minority. You know what I'm saying? It's
right.
Making you think,
right.
Gee, I don't want to go to a Negro doctor. Maybe he's the one they just let slide in with lower grades. Maybe he doesn't know as much. And that's a terrible put down. I think they should be as equal as anybody else that takes it.
Well, hopefully the graduation requirements are different from the admission requirements.
They're not. I had a probationer who was a Harvard graduate, and she typed theses, both black and white. This is going to make it feel even worse. And they couldn't spell and they couldn't write.
Well, I'm glad we got fine for affirmative action, but that is the cutting edge of the debate today. You see that a lot of them talk about equality in terms of affirmative action, or talking about equality in terms of segregation under the law, which is where we were not too long ago.